I'm Mike Jurenski. I'm over at the Stern School of Business. I'm also one of the co-directors of the Center for Advanced Technology. And on behalf of all of us and the Computer Science Department, I want to welcome you here. I want to say a few comments before I turn it over to Ed, who's going to introduce the speaker. The role of a university, as we say, is a place to foster debate and to have interesting discussions. And the role of a major university is to have particularly interesting discussions. And this particular presentation, this seminar, falls right into that mold. I find the discussion of open source particularly interesting. In a sense,
I do free software. Open source.
When I first started in the field in the 60s, basically software was free. And we went in cycles. It became free, and then some of the manufacturers, in the need to expand their markets, pushed it in other directions. A lot of the developments that took place with the entry of PC moved in exactly the same kind of a cycle. There's a very interesting French philosopher, Pierre Levé, who talks about the movement in this direction and who talks about the movement to cyberspace and not only relating to technology, but also relating to social restructuring, to political restructuring, to a change in the kinds of relationships that will improve the well-being of mankind. And we're hoping that this debate is a movement in that direction, that this debate is something that cuts across a lot of the disciplines that normally act as silos within the university. We're looking forward to some very interesting discussions. Ed?
Okay. I'm Ed Schomburg from the Computer Science Department at the Brown Institute. Let me welcome you all to this event. Introducers are usually a particularly useless aspect of public presentations, but in this case, actually, they serve a useful purpose, as Mike easily demonstrated, because an introducer for Richard Stallman, by making inaccurate comments, can allow him to straighten out and correct and sharpen considerably the parameters of the debate. Let me make the briefest possible introduction to somebody who doesn't need one. Richard is the perfect example of somebody who, by acting locally, started thinking globally from problems concerning the unavailability of source code for printer drivers at the AI lab many years ago. He has developed a coherent philosophy that has forced all of us to re-examine our ideas of how software is produced, of what intellectual property means, and what the software community actually represents. Let me welcome Richard Stallman.
Can someone lend me a watch? Thank you. So, I'd like to thank Microsoft for providing me the opportunity of this platform for the past few weeks. I have felt like an author whose book was fortuitously banned somewhere, except that all the articles about it are giving the wrong author's name. Because Microsoft described the GNU GPL as an open source license, and most of the press coverage followed suit, most people, of course, just innocently don't realize that our work has nothing to do with open source, that in fact we did most of it before people even coined the term open source. We are in the free software movement. And I'm going to speak about what the free software movement is about, what it means, what we have done. And because this is partly sponsored by a school of business, I'll say some things more than I usually do about how free software relates to business and some other areas of social life. Now, some of you may not ever write computer programs, but perhaps you cook. And if you cook, unless you're really great, you probably use recipes. And if you use recipes, you've probably had the experience of getting a copy of a recipe from a friend and sharing it. And you've probably also had the experience, unless you're a total neophyte, of changing a recipe. You know, it says certain things, but you don't have to do exactly that. You can leave out some ingredients, you know, add some mushrooms because you like mushrooms, put in less salt because your doctor said you should cut down on salt, whatever. You can even make bigger changes according to your skill. And if you've made changes in a recipe and you cook it for your friends and they like it, one of your friends might say, hey, could I have the recipe? And then what do you do? You could write down your modified version of the recipe and make a copy for your friend. These are the natural things to do with functionally useful recipes of any kind. Now, recipe is a lot like a computer program. A computer program is a lot like a recipe, a series of steps to be carried out to get some result that you want. So it's just as natural to do those same things with computer programs. Hand a copy to your friend. Make changes in it because the job it was written to do isn't exactly what you want. You know, it did a great job for somebody else, but your job is a different job. And after you've changed it, that's likely to be useful for other people. Maybe they have a job to do that's like the job you do. So they ask, hey, can I have a copy? Of course, if you're a nice person, you're going to give a copy. That's the way to be a decent person. So imagine what it would be like if recipes were packaged inside black boxes. You couldn't see what ingredients they're using, let alone change them. And imagine if you made a copy for a friend, they would call you a pirate and try to put you in prison for years. That world would create tremendous outrage from all the people who are used to sharing recipes. But that is exactly what the world of proprietary software is like, a world in which common decency towards other people is prohibited or prevented. Now, why did I notice this? I noticed this because of my good fortune in the 1970s to be part of a community of programmers who shared software. Now, this community could trace its ancestry essentially back to the beginning of computing. In the 1970s, though, it was a bit rare for there to be a community where people shared software. And in fact, this was sort of an extreme case because in the lab where I worked, the entire operating system was software developed by the people in our community, and we'd share any of it with anybody. Anybody was welcome to come and take a look and take away a copy and do whatever you wanted to do. There were no copyright notices on these programs. Cooperation was our way of life. And we were secure in that way of life. We didn't fight for it. We didn't have to fight for it. We just lived that way. And as far as we knew, we would just keep on living that way. So there was free software, but there was no free software movement. But then, our community was destroyed by a series of calamities that happened to it. Ultimately, it was wiped out. Ultimately, the PDP-10 computer, which we used for all our work, was discontinued. And, you know, our system, the incompatible time-sharing system, was written starting in the 60s, so it was written in assembler language. That's what you used to write an operating system in the 60s. So, of course, assembler language is for one particular computer architecture. If that gets discontinued, all your work turns into dust. It's useless. And that's what happened to us. The 20 years or so of work of our community turned into dust. But before this happened, I had an experience that prepared me, helped me see what to do, helped prepare me to see what to do when this happened. Because at a certain point, Xerox gave the Artificial Intelligence Lab where I worked a laser printer. Now, this was a really handsome gift because it was the first time anybody outside Xerox had a laser printer. It was very fast, printed a page a second, very fine in many respects, but it was unreliable because it was really a high-speed office copier that had been modified into a printer. And, you know, copiers jam, but there's somebody there to fix it. The printer jammed and nobody saw. So it stayed jammed for a long time. Well, we had an idea for how to deal with this problem. Change it so that whenever the printer gets a jam, the machine that runs the printer can tell our time-sharing machine and tell the users who are waiting for printouts or something like that, you know, tell them, go fix the printer. Because if they only knew it was jammed, of course, you know, if you're waiting for a printout and you know the printer is jammed, you don't want to sit and wait forever. You're going to go fix it. But at that point, we were completely stymied because the software that ran that printer was not free software. It had come with the printer, and it was just a binary. We couldn't have the source code. Xerox wouldn't let us have the source code. So, despite our skill as programmers, after all, we'd written our own time-sharing system, we were completely helpless to add this feature to the printer software. And we just had to suffer with waiting. It would take an hour or two to get your printout because the machine would be jammed most of the time. And only once in a while, you'd wait an hour figuring, I know it's going to be jammed, I'll wait an hour and go collect my printout. And then you'd see that it had been jammed the whole time, and in fact, nobody else had fixed it. So you fix it and you go wait another half hour. Then you come back, you see it jammed again before it got to your output. It would print 3 minutes and be jammed 30 minutes. Frustration up the wazoo. But the thing that made it worse was knowing that we could have fixed it, but somebody else, for his own selfishness, was blocking us, obstructing us from improving the software. So, of course, we felt some resentment. And then I heard that somebody at Carnegie Mellon University had a copy of that software. So I was visiting there later, so I went to his office, and I said, hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have a copy of the printer source code? And he said, no, I promised not to give you a copy. I was stunned. I was angry, and I had no idea how I could do justice to it. All I could think of was to turn around on my heel and walk out of his room. Maybe I slammed the door. But I thought about it later on, because I realized that I was seeing not just an isolated jerk, but a social phenomenon that was important and affected a lot of people. This was, for me, I was lucky. I only got a taste of it. But other people had to live in this all the time. So I thought about it at length. See, he had promised to refuse to cooperate with us, his colleagues at MIT. He had betrayed us. But he didn't just do it to us. Chances are he did it to you too. And I think most likely he did it to you too. He probably did it to you as well. He probably did it to most of the people here in this room, except a few maybe who weren't born yet in 1980. Because he had promised to refuse to cooperate with just about the entire population of the planet Earth. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. Now, this was my first direct encounter with a non-disclosure agreement, and it taught me an important lesson, a lesson that's important because most programmers never learn it. See, this was my first encounter with a non-disclosure agreement, and I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They're not innocent. They're not harmless. Most programmers first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some temptation, some goodie they're going to get if they sign. So they make up excuses. They say, well, he's never going to get a copy no matter what, so why shouldn't I join the conspiracy to deprive him? They say, this is the way it's always done. Who am I to go against it? They say, if I don't sign this, someone else will. Various excuses to gag their consciences. But when somebody invited me to sign a non-disclosure agreement, my conscience was already sensitized. It remembered how angry I had been when somebody promised not to help me and my whole lab solve our problem. And I couldn't turn around and do the exact same thing to somebody else who had never done me any harm. You know, if somebody asked me to promise not to share some useful information with a hated enemy, I would have said yes. You know, if somebody's done something bad, he deserves it. But strangers, they haven't done me any harm. How could they deserve that kind of mistreatment? You can't let yourself start treating just anybody and everybody badly. Then you become a predator on society. So I said, thank you very much for offering me this nice software package, but I can't accept it in good conscience on the conditions you are demanding, so I will do without it. Thank you so much. And so I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information, such as software. Now, there are other kinds of information which raise different ethical issues. For instance, there's personal information. You know, if you wanted to talk with me about what was happening between you and your boyfriend and you asked me not to tell anybody, I could agree to keep that a secret for you, because that's not generally useful technical information. At least it's probably not generally useful. There is a small chance, there's a possibility though, that you might reveal to me some marvelous new sex technique, and I would then feel a moral duty to pass it on to the rest of humanity so that everyone can get the benefit of it. So I'd have to put a proviso in that promise, you know. If it's just details about who wants this and who's angry at whom and things like that, the soap opera, that I can keep private for you. But something that humanity could tremendously benefit from knowing, I mustn't withhold. You see, the purpose of science and technology is to develop useful information for humanity to help people live their lives better. If we promise to withhold that information, if we keep it secret, then we are betraying the mission of our field. And this I decided I shouldn't do. But meanwhile, my community had collapsed, and that was collapsing, and that left me in a bad situation. You see, the whole incompatible time sharing system was obsolete because the PDP-10 was obsolete. And so there was no way I could continue working as an operating system developer the way I had been doing it. That depended on being part of the community, using the community's software and improving it. That no longer was a possibility. And that gave me a moral dilemma. What was I going to do? Because the most obvious possibility meant to go against that decision I had made. And the most obvious possibility was to adapt myself to the change in the world, to accept that things were different and that I'd have to just give up those principles and start signing non-disclosure agreements for proprietary operating systems and most likely writing proprietary software as well. But I realized that way I could have fun coding and I could make money, especially if I did it other than at MIT. But at the end, I'd have to look back at my career and say, I've spent my life building walls to divide people. And I would have been ashamed of my life. So I looked for another alternative, and there was an obvious one. I could leave the software field, do something else. Now, I had no other special noteworthy skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Not at a fancy restaurant, they wouldn't hire me, but I could be a waiter somewhere. And many programmers, they say to me, if the people who hire programmers demand this, this, and this, if I don't do those things, I'll starve. It's literally the word they use. Well, you know, as a waiter, you're not going to starve. So really, they're in no danger. But, and this is important, you see, because sometimes you can justify doing something that hurts other people by saying, otherwise something worse is going to happen to me. You know, if you were really going to starve, you'd be justified in writing proprietary software. If somebody's pointing a gun at you, then I would say it's forgivable. But I had found a way I could survive without doing something unethical. So that excuse was not available. So I realized, though, that being a waiter would be no fun for me, and it would be wasting my skills as an operating system developer. It would avoid misusing my skills. Developing proprietary software would be misusing my skills. Encouraging other people to live in the world of proprietary software would be misusing my skills. But so it's better to waste them than misuse them, but it's still not really good. So for those reasons, I decided to look for some other alternative. What can an operating system developer do that would actually improve the situation, make the world a better place? And I realized that an operating system developer was exactly what was needed. The problem, the dilemma, existed for me and for everyone else because all the available operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. The free operating systems were for old obsolete computers, right? So for the modern computers, if you wanted to get a modern computer and use it, you were forced into a proprietary operating system. So if an operating system developer wrote another operating system and then said, everybody come and share this, you're welcome to this, that would give everybody a way out of the dilemma, another alternative. So I realized that there was something I could do that would solve the problem. I had just the right skills to be able to do it. And it was the most useful thing I could possibly imagine that I'd be able to do with my life. And it was a problem that no one else was trying to solve. It was just sort of sitting there, getting worse. And nobody was there but me. So I felt, I'm elected. I have to work on this. If not me, who? So I decided I would develop a free operating system or die trying. Of old age, of course. So, of course, I had to decide what kind of operating system it should be. There are some technical design decisions to be made. I decided to make the system compatible with Unix for a number of reasons. First of all, I had just seen one operating system that I really loved become obsolete because it was written for one particular kind of computer. I didn't want that to happen again. We needed to have a portable system. Well, Unix was a portable system. So if I followed the design of Unix, I had a pretty good chance that I could make a system that would also be portable and workable. And furthermore, why be compatible with it in the details? The reason is users hate incompatible changes. If I had just design the system in my favorite way, which I would have loved doing, I'm sure, I would have produced something that was incompatible. You know, the details would be different. So if I wrote the system, then the users would have said to me, well, this is very nice, but it's incompatible. It would be too much work to switch. We can't afford that much trouble just to use your system instead of Unix. So we'll stay with Unix, they would have said. Now, if I wanted to actually create a community where there would be people in it, people using this free system and enjoying the benefits of liberty and cooperation, I had to make a system people would use, a system that they would find easy to switch to, that would not have an obstacle making it fail at the very beginning. Now, making the system upward compatible with Unix actually made all the immediate design decisions, because Unix consists of many pieces, and they communicate through interfaces that are more or less documented. So if you want to be compatible with Unix, you have to replace each piece one by one with a compatible piece. So the remaining design decisions are inside one piece, and they could be made later by whoever decides to write that piece. They didn't have to be made at the outset. So all we had to do to start work was find a name for the system. Now, we hackers always look for a funny or naughty name for a program, because thinking of people being amused by the name is half the fun of writing a program. And we had a tradition of recursive acronyms to say that the program you're writing is similar to some existing program. You can say, you can give it a recursive acronym name which says this one's not the other. So, for instance, there were many Tico text editors in the 60s and 70s, and they were generally called something or other Tico. Then one clever hacker called his Tint, for Tint is not Tico, the first recursive acronym. In 1975, I developed the first Emacs text editor, and there were many imitations of Emacs, and a lot of them were called something or other Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. That was a stripped-down imitation. And then Ina was almost completely rewritten, and the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So I looked for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix, and I tried all 26 letters and discovered that none of them was a word. Try another way. I made a contraction. That way I could have a three-letter acronym for something's not Unix. And I tried letters and I came across the word GNU. The word GNU is the funniest word in the English language. So that was it.